In North Korea, it's Bill Clinton to the rescue.
Line up. We got the call.
Barack Obama sends Bill Clinton to try and help with the release of two American citizens convicted of espionage and sentenced to 12 years hard labor. A long-standing tradition in American diplomacy, when presidents really want to make a deal with a rogue state, they send in the former presidents. Bill Clinton in Pyongyang. Go, Bill Clinton. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, August 4th. I'm John Hockenberry, and it is a serious rescue mission for former President Bill Clinton this morning in North Korea. Amy Holmes is with us all week, former Senate speechwriter, writer, political analyst. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. So on the show today, we have a number of stories. We're following three American hikers detained in Iran, the political difficulties of vacationing on the vineyard, I guess, beach or pool, Swiss banks give up their secrets, and seeking Gitmo alternatives in the United States. What's the matter with, say, Kansas?
Plenty, it turns out.
First, we have Jim Walsh, North Korea watcher and professor at MIT, to discuss North Korea. So, Jim, this was a real stealth arrival for Bill Clinton, right?
Yes, it's like trying to smuggle a rock star into a small town. It was a shocker. And in fact, none of the U.S. press picked up on it. The first media group to report on it was a foreign group from Asia. So it came as a big surprise to everyone.
Well, we're going to stay on this story. And Jim Walsh, thank you. Stay with us. And we're going to continue the conversation in just a few moments. But first, a look at some of the news stories we're following this morning.
In the headlines, another Clinton to the rescue. Secretary Clinton pressed Iran to release those three American hikers detained in Iran and reportedly being interrogated under arrest. That's according to an Iranian official. Hillary Clinton embarks on her seven-nation tour, meanwhile, an 11-day tour of Africa today. She kicks off in Kenya, where she'll meet with Somalia's interim leaders. Amy?
In business, the world's top automaker, Toyota, is reporting an $800 million loss last quarter, but it says the rest of the year is looking up. That's as U.S. carmakers say cash for clunker rebates are boosting their bottom lines. Back here in Washington, or down south in Washington, the Senate is still trying to add another $2 billion to keep that cash for clunkers rebate running. But the big Senate debate today is on Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. A vote is expected later this week. It shouldn't be a cliffhanger since she has the backing of the Democratic majority.
And a few Republicans as well. In Afghanistan, the Taliban fired a series of rockets that hit Kabul today. Could be an escalation in that conflict. One of those rockets landed near the American embassy, and the attack comes ahead of presidential elections later this month. Defense Secretary Robert Gates has been overseas meeting with the top military leaders in Afghanistan. He flew to Belgium to hear from them firsthand. Some advisors are calling for more troops in Afghanistan.
Back in the U.S., a tropical storm is strengthening off the Pacific coast. Tropical storm Enrique is moving off the southern tip of the Baja Peninsula.
We'll learn about how consumer spending is driving or not driving the economy a little later on this morning. Markets were up more than 1% yesterday. The Dow opens next hour at 9287. The S&P starts at 10.02 and the Nasdaq begins at 20.09. Futures trading suggests a flat to down opening. President Obama celebrates his 48th birthday today. What is your birthday wish for the president? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Maybe a little ice cream, pizza, movie.
Time with the family.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Amy Holmes, in all week with John Hockenberry. John, we have the curious coincidence of Americans being held in not one, but two countries, both antagonists of the United States, Iran and North Korea. It's strange.
Well, a consistent narrative, and it's probably no accident that it's Iran and North Korea, nations that also have a very difficult diplomatic relationship with. The question really is, are these individuals detainees? Are they hostages? Are they diplomatic bargaining chips? Are they actually defendants? Well, the answer is they could be all of the above. Bill Clinton arrived in Pyongyang early this morning to negotiate the release of two American journalists there. Laura Ling and Una Lee have been convicted by the regime of grave crimes, which could be a euphemism for espionage. A friend of Laura Ling, Rob Everett, told the BBC show The World Today that he hoped Clinton's visit would help to secure the release of the women.
We have all been seeking some sign of movement towards the North Korean government showing amnesty towards these women. And I think that it's a very sort of cautiously hopeful about his time over there.
Well, we've been discussing this with Jim Walsh, who's a North Korea expert at MIT, the security studies program there. Bill Clinton famously attempted to negotiate, you may recall, an overall nuclear deal with the North Koreans right at the end of his administration back in 2000. And Jim, I'm wondering if the former president has a personal agenda here. I mean, this comes right after the North Koreans seem to offer an opening for some sort of bilateral talks, right after deciding not to talk with the United States for quite a while.
Well, John, you're right. This whole situation is layered with irony. You may remember even before Clinton expressed an interest in traveling to North Korea at the end of his second term, Jimmy Carter, a former president, intervened on a nuclear crisis under Bill Clinton's tenure, and the Clinton administration was less than thrilled about this intervention by an outsider, but it produced a positive result that led to an agreement that helped freeze North Korea's nuclear program. You know, whether Bill Clinton has a personal agenda on North Korea remains to be seen. It hasn't been a focus of his foundation. My guess is his main concern as a former president is that he doesn't want to go there unless he has some advance signal from North Korea that this is in fact going to be a successful trip. So the fact that he's going is something I take as a good sign that something is probably in the works.
So Jim, why do you suppose the Obama administration tapped Bill Clinton to make this trip, given his mixed track record with North Korea?
Well, I think Bill Clinton's record on North Korea is one where he wanted to accomplish something under his tenure.
Highly motivated.
Very, very close. But then it just sort of fell apart there as Florida chads and ballots were being examined. But I think in this case, it's probably President Obama and the Secretary of State who are making the decision as to whether to send Bill Clinton or not, unlike the Jimmy Carter situation where Carter sort of went on his own. It seems to me highly unlikely that this is something where Bill is freelancing. So the reports have been that Gore, a former Vice President Gore, might go. Certainly Bill Richardson, the former governor or current governor of New Mexico, had made similar trips in the past. But this seemed to be something that the North Koreans were interested in, to have a former president visit, and that's what probably sealed the deal.
But again, we're kind of stirring the pot here. I mean, this was so well concealed that, I mean, on some level, while what you're saying, Jim Walsh, of the MIT Security Studies Program is plausible, we actually don't know officially. But it is impossible to imagine that Hillary Clinton would have allowed Bill Clinton to just sort of go in on her own. Let's talk a little bit about the protocol in a situation like this. When there are people arrested, it's not the Secretary of State or the President that lead on something like this. It would be an envoy or a lower-level diplomat, correct?
That's most likely the case. Usually in diplomacy, you don't send the Secretary of State in at the drop of a hat. It's something that comes after a long process and where lower-level officials sort of pave the way for higher-level officials. But this is a special case. Again, it's a humanitarian mission, if you will, not sort of a straight-up two-nation negotiation on broad set of issues. At least that's not the way the U.S. is probably treating it. It's a special case with a special problem, and in those circumstances, it makes perfect sense to send an envoy, and in this case, an envoy who has some juice of his own.
But I have a question about that. Earlier, you described Bill Clinton as a rock star, so he brings a lot of attention, media attention, to these negotiations. Is there risk in that, and by extension, risk for the Obama administration?
Well, certainly, if it's an unsuccessful trip, then that would be a risk both personally for former President Clinton and for the administration. It would make them both look bad. But that's why and this is just a deduction on my part, but this is why I feel fairly confident that the former president wouldn't agree to this unless something had been agreed to in advance. And from what I'm hearing, this has been in the planning stages for at least a couple of weeks.
On the other side of the coin there, though, the North Koreans may want a rock star. I mean, only Bono would have a higher profile than Bill Clinton going in. I mean, that's exactly what they're looking for here, to reset the deck on these very, very frustrating nuclear talks that have been going on.
Well, precisely. precisely. It serves a political purpose for them insofar as he is high profile. He is a rock star. He's the highest ranking American to visit North Korea in roughly a decade.
Since Madeleine Albright.
Exactly. And then, and you can have a debate, which is a bigger deal, a sitting Secretary of State or a former president. They're all big. So this is a big deal for North Korea. It helps them at the level of pride and status and respect that they think they deserve, that they're not getting at a time when they're having an internal political transition, when we all think that the current leader, Kim Jong-il, is on his way out and going to be replaced by his youngest son. So for them, it serves several purposes. But for us, this is a big deal, too, not simply for the journalists, which is obviously important, but it does present an opportunity, and we don't want to put too much of a burden here, but an opportunity to reset, hit the reset button, as Bill's wife said, on the U.S.-Korean relationship, because you're meeting with Kim Jong-il. Americans never have an opportunity to meet with Kim Jong-il, and his word is the final word, so if they do manage to talk about the U.S.-Korean relationship in broader terms, there's at least the slimmest possibility that the thing could change because of this direct interaction.
Now, while we're certainly aware of this story, and Americans are aware of this story, it's still been fairly low profile. We haven't heard Laura's sister, Lisa Ling, who's quite well known to the American public, for example, making a public plea for her sister's release. Are there diplomatic reasons for that to kind of keep it under the radar a bit?
Absolutely, and I think you'll see the same thing happening with respect to the three hikers who were seized in Iran. But even more so in the case of North Korea. North Korea can be prickly. It's very sensitive. And at the end of the day, if they are holding the two journalists, then they have the cards on this particular issue. And name-calling and screaming and making it a big public deal doesn't normally work with the North Koreans and isn't going to help get them freed. It also simply raises the value of the bargaining chip, as it were, that the more you make it a public issue, the more those people being held are of political value and improves the bargaining position of the North. So for a variety of reasons in cases like this, and again, you'll see this with the Americans being held in Iran, low profile seems to be the way to go.
So, Jim, what are your predictions for success here? I mean, the fact is diplomatic efforts have not worked thus far. These women have been convicted and sentenced to 12 years of hard labor. Are North Koreans in a mood to negotiate?
I would have to guess yes, at least on this issue. This trip, I don't think, would be happening unless there was some evidence on both parties' parts that this was going to be a successful outcome. It serves neither North Korea nor the U.S. to have this end badly, and these opportunities are so few and far between that I don't think it happened. This is just no one called up and said, hey, you want to come over? And someone says, yeah, I guess I'll come over. This has been talked about, negotiated. The final deal may not be worked out, but there's at least a good enough chance that it's all going to work that both parties felt confident enough to give it a try.
Well, Jim Walsh, there's certainly a long tradition of quid pro quo, as the North Koreans are very skilled at getting what they want with the limited bargaining chips they have at their disposal. If North Korea should suddenly accredit a bunch of journalists from Seoul to come into Pyongyang to cover this, what should the response of Western media be? To go there or what?
Oh, I would think so. First of all, the Western media, particularly since things started to turn sour this spring, have not had the access that they've had in past years. For a while there, North Korea was sort of opening up and even allowing one agency to set up a little mini-bureau, and that all became much more difficult once rumors of Kim's stroke took place back in August of 2008. So I think anytime you get a chance to go into North Korea, speaking personally and professionally, you need to take it.
Well, I'd certainly go, Jim. Interesting stuff. Thanks so much for joining us. You were listening to Jim Walsh, a North Korea expert at MIT at the Security Studies Program there. And, there's a great documentary on North Korea done out of KCET Los Angeles, and it shows a traffic cop in the middle of Pyongyang directing, and there's no traffic. I would love to go to Pyongyang.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, President Obama turns a young 48 today, and we're asking you for your birthday wishes for the president. One listener emailed us her birthday wishes. Miriam Hyde says, quote, all the Democrats in Congress get their acts together and start to completely get behind what you
there's
want.
There's a present. Wow.
There's something. So tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Let us know what you tell the president.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. So, Amy, I know, Amy Holmes, by the way, I know you have all your assets tied up in Swiss bank accounts.
Oh, yes.
And stuff. And if you do
piles
watch
of leprechaun
the Swiss,
gold. Yes.
If you do watch the Swiss banking industry these days, it's been some uncharacteristic volatility. UBS is reporting extraordinary outflows of money from its accounts. At the same time, shares in the Swiss bank UBS rose sharply yesterday. Details are starting to emerge of a deal between the Swiss and U.S. government regarding tax evasion. The U.S. has been trying to get the names released of some 52,000 wealthy Americans, or Americans with deposits anyway, suspected of evading taxes by hiding billions of dollars with UBS and other Swiss banks. Let's check in on this story a little bit with Bill Sharp, who's a lawyer representing a number of clients with Swiss bank accounts, including UBS. Good morning, Bill.
John, good morning. How are you today?
And you're joining us from your home there in Tampa, Florida.
Yes, sir, I sure am.
Now, South Florida isn't a place for, like, tax evaders to go and hang out, right?
Well, let's put it this way, John. When UBS did conduct a great deal of stateside marketing, a couple of its major grounds for marketing were, of course, Florida and New York.
Interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit about what's at stake here. Now, if the UBS bank decides to release tens of thousands of names here as part of a deal with the U.S. government, what are the consequences there?
Well, in my view, what we're talking about here is the integrity and, frankly, the longevity of the Swiss banking system on the one hand, and that's competing, of course, against the U.S. legal system and particularly our tax administration rules that seek full disclosure. What's really at stake here is that if UBS and the Swiss government stumble and don't properly handle this request, then it could undermine Swiss banking for a long time.
Now, are you in a strange position here, a U.S. lawyer representing clients with Swiss bank accounts, but you're essentially making an argument that's in favor of Swiss law, not American law?
Well, as an international tax lawyer, you have to look at all views and come up with the right approach, hopefully in the best interest of your client. And we only represent individuals, not the banks. But here's how it works is UBS is reluctant to release all 52,000 names because Swiss banking secrecy rules say you can't do that. There are certain exceptions, however, to those rules, one called the Swiss tax fraud or the like exception. And if the conduct of a particular account falls within that exception, then they can make the release. And that's what this is all about. We're trying to determine whether and to what extent a large number of names can be released under that exception.
So you're arguing, though, sort of on the technicality of this. Are you arguing that your clients are innocent of these allegations?
We're not really judging our clients, Amy. What we're really looking at is, I mean, and let's back up on that a little bit. First of all, thank goodness we have the Constitution, because folks are entitled to counsel in this country. And secondly, in many of these cases, clients are seeking to come clean, become compliant through what's called voluntary disclosure. And in many of these cases, too, clients were inadvertently trapped. They've inherited money from folks they had very little dealings with. Some of them are perhaps more egregious than others, but there's no question about it. There are a lot of innocent folks out there. Mm.
Well, Bill, before we go, is it possible that this gets even more complicated in the sense that possibly, aside from evading taxes, that some of these secret bank accounts may disclose, like, affairs or mistresses or relationships or explode families, and that you would have to use an argument like that to say, look, we can't be releasing this because it would cause all kinds of other problems?
Well, you know, unfortunately, that wouldn't be a bar for releasing it if, in fact, the conduct in question constituted tax fraud under Swiss law or the like. That's the only way the Swiss would be able to release names, and that's what they're trying to balance right now. They're trying to figure out, gee, I mean, from the Swiss perspective, they're saying, how can we possibly satisfy the U.S. demands in a case that we will probably but not necessarily lose in South Florida? And the only way they can satisfy that demand is seek a legal vehicle
right
under Swiss law.
Swiss law and U.S. law, the issue is tax evasion. Bill Sharp, lawyer representing a number of clients with the Swiss bank UBS, joined us from Tampa, Florida. Thanks, Bill.
Speaking of the wealthy, if you're a U.S. president and you don't happen to have a summer compound like Kennebunkport, for example, where do you go? What do you do?
Well, Camp David?
apparently don't go to Six Flags.
No, no.
Obama and the family are heading to Martha's Vineyard at the end of the month.
How nice
and
for
with,
them.
Very nice for them. With us to discuss it is Nelson Siegelman, managing editor of Martha's Vineyard Times. Nelson, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. So are residents preparing for this big presidential visit at the end of the month?
Well, I understand there are already T-shirts saying I vacation with Obama for sale along Circuit Avenue in Oak Bluff, so I guess some folks are preparing for it.
But you've had presidents there before. Are some residents kind of saying, you know, been there, done that?
I think that's sort of overplayed a bit. I mean, folks still get excited. I mean, let's face it, when the motorcade pulls up and the president walks in and about 20 Secret Service folks are all around them, it's a little bit hard to pretend you're blasé about it.
Yeah, so, that's pretty dazzling.
Or if you're stuck in a traffic jam because a motorcade's going through, I suppose you vote for the next party in the next election. So,
so the Clintons, they famously stayed with Vernon Jordan. Do we know where the Obamas are going to be?
Well, the Clintons didn't stay with Vern Jordan. Bill Clinton played golf with him. But as for the Obamas, they're going to be staying at the Blue Heron Farm in Chilmark. It's a private compound at the end of a long dirt road, like a lot of private homes on Martha's Vineyard that wealthy folks own. The average person is not going to see something like that.
Is it beachfront for the Obamas?
It's on a salt pond. It's a very nice place, and it has easy access to the beach. So I don't think it's going to be lacking for any amenities.
So do you expect the Obamas just to mix and mingle with the locals, you know, go down and get some ice cream with the girls?
Well, they haven't shared their itinerary with me yet, but I've got to expect that he does have two young girls. As anyone who has young girls knows, they're going to want to go out and do things and have fun. So I expect they'll visit some of the attractions that make Martha's Vineyard such a popular vacation destination.
Attractions / overpriced boutiques.
Well, I don't know about that, but they're, you know, we have a very old carousel called the Flying Horses, and that's always a fun thing for any family to visit.
Thank you, Nelson Siegelman, for joining us this morning. That was Nelson Siegelman, managing editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times.
He was very, very diplomatic there about the boutiques, but that carousel is a beautiful thing.
Oh, wow. I'll have to check it out. Now for a look at some of the news stories we're following this morning.
And in the headlines, North Korea welcomed former President Bill Clinton to Pyongyang with flowers and handshakes. He arrived there for a surprise visit to try and win the release of two jailed American journalists there. And in Afghanistan, the Taliban fired a series of rockets that hit Kabul today. One of them landed near the American embassy, and the attack comes ahead of presidential elections that the Taliban has asked Afghanis to boycott elections later this month. Amy?
Defense Secretary Robert Gates has been overseas, meeting with top military leaders in Afghanistan. He flew to Belgium to hear from them firsthand. Some advisors are calling for more troops. Staying overseas, the other Clinton mover and shaker, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, she embarks on her seven-nation, 11-day tour of Africa. Today, she kicks it off in Kenya, where she'll meet with Somalia's interim leaders.
And birthday boy in chief, okay, happy birthday, Mr. President. Yes, Barack Obama turns 48 today, his birthday present, a day filled with closed-door meetings at the White House on health care and the Middle East.
Oh, what
thank
joy.
You. Just what I was asking for.
Coming up on The Takeaway, Afghan police say Taliban insurgents have launched a missile strike on the city of Kabul. What does this mean in the run-up to that country's presidential election? More on that in the story coming up.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry, joined all week by Amy Holmes.
Good morning.
And back in the 90s, a rocket attack on the city of Kabul in Afghanistan was not news. It happened all the time. And we're checking in this morning on what it's fair to say is Obama's war in Afghanistan. 9 rockets fired by the Taliban this morning into the Afghan capital of Kabul, possibly escalating the situation there. One of the rockets landed in the diplomatic district close to the U.S. and other Western embassies. Earlier this morning, we spoke with David Loin in Kabul, BBC foreign correspondent, author of the book In Afghanistan, which is just out here in the United States. I asked David whether people in Kabul are feeling as though this is a bit of a flashback to the 90s, when there were signs of air raids and rocket attacks on virtually every building in the city.
Well, John, that's exactly the fear. I mean, you remember what it was like then before. In fact, before the Taliban came in the mid-90s, when there were these indiscriminate rocket attacks, killed tens of thousands of people, destroyed the southern suburbs of the city in that civil war before the Taliban emerged in the mid-90s. And that's exactly the fear of Kabul residents that one of them said to me, could it all be starting all over again? I must say, when I first was woken up by one of the rockets this morning, they were very much one after the other in quite an intense period, around about 5 minutes. I thought it was a distant boom, and I thought it was probably Taliban being bombed somewhere away from the city. And to wake up later and see the damage in a building not very far away from where I was sleeping, and to hear that actually these had been rockets was a real surprise, because it's the first time since 2001, apart from some isolated mortar attacks, that the Taliban have been able to carry out an attack of this sort.
And we should remind people that during the entire 90s, there was no civil authority in Afghanistan. In fact, ambulances had to cross an artillery line in Kabul to even get to the hospital, because the city was divided and controlled by various factions. So the Taliban know exactly what they're doing here, trying to signal that they're willing to actually suspend all civil authority as a front against the NATO coalition.
Yes, and I think it does mark a real change from the Taliban's point of view, and a certain amount of cynicism that they don't mind that there might be civilian casualties. I mean, most of these rockets fell, in fact, in open areas. Only 2 civilians were injured in them. One of the rockets failed to explode at all. But if they had killed people, then that would have been a real move for the Taliban, who've always said that they wanted to protect civilians and not to damage the population, not to lose popular support. But I think it shows that they want to disrupt the elections, and they don't mind quite how it is that they do it.
David, this is Amy Holmes here. We understand that some British parliamentarians are critical of the strategy in Afghanistan. Do these attacks prove them right?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's hard to sort of take a whole political stance just from one series of rocket attacks. But, you know, again, today there was a roadside bomb that exploded on against a convoy of a provincial governor on his way into Kabul. There have been attempts on the lives of several election candidates and campaign coordinators, and it shows how difficult it is to run open democracy at a time of conflict. And I think what House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee report at the weekend, which was very strongly critical of the British government, was trying to say was that the international community, Britain in particular, are trying to do too much. You can't fight a war at the same time as fighting narcotics, at the same time as trying to build democracy. You need to focus a bit on exactly what it is that you can achieve rather than spreading everything all around.
Well, David Loin, they particularly were talking about actually opening some sort of dialogue with the Taliban. Let's review the bidding a little bit. We've got 9 rockets this morning. We've got serious casualties, the worst casualty count during the month of July in the entire war. We've got elections on August 20th, and on the New York Times front page this morning, people say they don't believe the elections are going to take place. The Taliban was saying that Afghanis should boycott these elections. These rockets seem like a deliberate attempt to really completely disrupt anything that's going to take place between now and August 20th.
I think that's very much the intention. I'm not sure I entirely agree with that New York Times report. I mean, there was a lot of suspicion as to whether elections could take place here in 2005, and they did. The test that Richard Holbrooke, now the US envoy for the whole region, has put on is that the election process should be credible and legitimate. The international community realise that it's rough and ready. It won't be a perfect democracy. It won't be a perfect test of the electorate in the way that some Western countries might be governed, might run their elections. But even though it's rough and ready, I think there is a hope and expectation that some form of polling will take place. If it does, it'll be the first time in Afghan history that there's been the second presidential election in a row. You've had one president elected and then another, whether it's Hamid Karzai or not. But I think there is certainly a real concern on the part of the international community that despite the large number of foreign forces in the country, they still haven't got a grip of the security. And I have to say, I just mentioned some of the themes that I wrote about in my book is just how hard it is once you take a country, once you take Afghanistan, to hold it and to impose your will, because it's such a complex country. And I think the international community are only just beginning to realize quite how complicated it is.
Which brings me to my next question. What about the efforts then to reach out to, you know, quote unquote, moderate Taliban? Does all of this violence complicate that effort?
Well, I think the history of counterinsurgency negotiations, and certainly the British government saw this in Northern Ireland, is that they can go on at the same time as there is real bloodshed and real conflict. The line is on these negotiations, and I think there's been a lot written in the last few days trying to say the UN takes one view about negotiations, the US takes another view, the UK takes another view, and the House of Commons MPs committee take another view. I think they're all nuances, really, on what is now an accepted view of the international community that there should be negotiations with those Taliban who want to negotiate. And as one diplomat put it to me this week, if you're Hillary Clinton's definition was about irreconcilable. She said, "I won't talk to those who are irreconcilable." Well, a diplomat said to me this week, "It's up to them to define who's irreconcilable." You know, there is now a will to talk to senior Taliban if they'll come across and potentially talk to the international community.
Right.
But at the same time, the conflict on both sides is going on.
And to some extent, the Taliban seem to be driving it. That was David Loyne, BBC foreign correspondent and author of the book In Afghanistan, who spoke to us earlier this morning. And now for a look at some of the news stories we're following this morning as well. Amy?
Just getting in some new economic data this morning about how much Americans made and spent last month. Consumer spending increased in June for the second straight month, while income dropped more than expected. On Capitol Hill, the full Senate opens the floor for debate today on Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. She has the support of the Democratic majority, plus a handful of Republicans. A vote on her confirmation is expected later this week.
I love the sounds of democracy, don't you?
Indeed. While the Senate is still busy at work, the House is out for August recess. Lawmakers are back home hearing from their constituents who have plenty to say. Here's what some of those protesting Indiana residents had to say about their congressman this past week.
It's not a congressional recess. It's a hose down. Coming up, Gitmo in Kansas. We'll find out about that. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Hockenberry. You know, they call it a recess for lawmakers there in Washington, but as we were listening
there
to those
town meetings,
there was
nothing at play there.
Those healthcare town meetings sound more like a hose down or a hazing on the part of lawmakers. So I don't know how much of a vacation it's going to feel like, but let's look at the sort of job description. They get a lot of paid vacation right now, 5 weeks paid vacation, 5 for the House, 4 weeks for the Senate. That's the summer recess. Joining us now to talk about the ethics of taking a vacation, of the government taking a vacation in the middle of all kinds of crises, one or another. Randy Cohen writes the Ethicist blog for the New York Times Magazine and author of the moral of the story blog on the NewYorkTimes.com, and he writes The the ethicist for the New York Times Magazine. Good morning, Randy. Sorry to get that all wrong.
It's okay, John. I get it all wrong every week.
Well, it's my moral, it's my empty moral soul. You know what I mean? But that's why I talk to you. First of all, you know, they work pretty hard on Capitol Hill. They
Everybody certainly works pretty hard. Coal miners work pretty hard.
There you go.
Meat plants work really hard.
So why does it stick in the craw of Americans that lawmakers get such generous vacation?
Well, actually, I think you understated with the 5 weeks. Congress has had, at the end of August, they will have had 8 weeks off already this year. They took time off in April, May, and February. The average American takes about 12 days off. It's hard not to see this as guys exploiting a position of public trust for personal gain. They vote themselves this time off. That's what we would call unethical.
But isn't there a constitutional narrative here of originally they wanted lawmakers to go spend time with the constituents? They had to really make time for that?
There was some credence in that kind of argument in 1789, but that was pre-cell phone, pre-phone, pre-email, and pre-having an office in your district that representatives have no trouble staying in touch with constituents. I believe lobbyists are right in town with they don't need a suitcase to pack the cash.
But Randy, I got to say, I'm still, you know, I'm sympathetic to these guys from my years of working in the Senate. Maybe it's just
she's got a conflict of interest.
Maybe it's just a problem of terminology. These guys work really hard. When they go home, it's to, you know, meet with constituents, also fundraisers. I mean, they don't have a lot of downtime.
Well, fundraising, I'm not sure if you can justify fundraising as doing the nation's work. That seems self-serving to me.
It's not a pina colada at the beach.
Nonetheless,
necessarily.
If you believe in an egalitarian society as a moral idea, it seems to me we should have not a coterie of aristocrats, but people who live pretty much like those they govern, which means you should have about the same amount of vacation time as all Americans. You know.
All right. Well, let's hone it down then. What would be an appropriate amount of vacation time for a lawmaker on Capitol Hill?
Two weeks? It should be about what their constituents get, what we Americans get. The European Union guarantees 4 weeks, and that seems a fair comparison because they're an advanced industrial democracy. We're an advanced industrial democracy. The amount of vacation time guaranteed by federal law to ordinary Americans is zero. We get none.
But are you saying politicians should get 4 weeks? So basically the August recess?
I'm saying they should get what they should guarantee to the citizenry, the same thing they take for themselves.
Here's a more complex moral nuance. Okay, here we go. What if you came upon your lawmaker on vacation and it appeared that he or she was having a really good time? Is that bad?
I'm for happiness. I'm for vacations, but I'm saying you can't, if you're making the laws, you can't grab for yourself what you then deny to other people.
All right.
I believe in this whole idea of an egalitarian society. I believe in that. That's a moral ideal.
Well, you can find out what Randy Cohen believes in by reading The Ethicist for the New York Times Magazine and author of the Moral of the Story blog on the NewYorkTimes.com. Thanks, Randy.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry with Amy Holmes. So empty Gitmo out and take all of its inmates to Kansas or Michigan. What would that mean? We'll find out. First, some headlines.
The White House isn't commenting on former President Bill Clinton's surprise visit to North Korea today. He arrived in an unmarked plane. President Clinton is negotiating for the release of the two American journalists detained there. The other Clinton, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, is in Africa for a seven-nation, 11-day tour. She kicks off her visit in Kenya, where she'll speak with Somalia's interim leaders.
And Chelsea is on the International Space Station. Did you realize that? Actually, that's not true at all. That's completely incorrect. Back in the U.S., at least 1,100 firefighters have joined the battle against wildfires north of Sacramento, California. Series of fires were ignited by lightning and have consumed hundreds of acres of land. And the number of Americans taking antidepressants has more than doubled in a decade, according to a study published today in the Archives of General Psychiatry.
And that's a look at some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
So we talked about it a moment ago. It was a campaign issue. It's going to be a more important issue going forward in the Obama administration, legally and in security terms. What to do with Guantanamo Bay, the place where the Bush administration detained alleged terrorists following the September 11th attacks? What's going to happen to Guantanamo Bay? Here's President Obama.
I have said repeatedly that I intend to close Guantanamo, and I will follow through on that.
And here's Kansas Republican Senator Sam Brownback in a news conference talking about what the intention of the Obama administration might actually be.
It is not supported by the American public and will not change the world's opinion of us one iota by substituting the name Leavenworth for the name Guantanamo.
So you can close Guantanamo, but what do you do to the people who are actually there being detained? According to unnamed officials, the administration is toying with an idea of trying the 220 or so prisoners left at Gitmo in courtrooms in the continental United States, which raises the question, where will they be detained? Not in the nation's capital, not in New York. Instead, how's the Midwest sound for a trial there? Kansas Republican Senator Sam Brownback suggests Leavenworth, Kansas, is one of a few places the White House is reportedly looking into. Joining us now is Shea Baker, mayor of Leavenworth, Kansas, en route to Topeka, Kansas. Good morning, Shea.
Good morning.
Now, Mayor, is this a controversial decision in your neck of the woods?
It certainly is. We are not interested in having these detainees at Fort Leavenworth.
Although you deal with all kinds of dangerous people at Fort Leavenworth, what would make these any different?
Well, obviously, these people, probably the main concern that we have are necessarily these alleged terrorists. It is the allies and the followers of these detainees that we're really nervous about. We have no problem keeping prisoners in. We do it very well at both the U.S. Penitentiary and at the disciplinary barracks. Our concern is that the followers of these detainees would come into our community and attempt a terrorist attack. They've strapped bombs to themselves and are known to want to cause chaos and make a statement, and we don't want them to make that statement in our community.
All right, Shea Baker, mayor of Leavenworth, Kansas, stay with us. Joining us now, Paul Pichet, a guard at the Standish Correctional Facility in Omer, Michigan. Paul, how does the presence of these kinds of detainees, and again, it's an open question as to what kind of a threat these Guantanamo detainees are. Some have been actually adjudicated to be completely innocent and should be released, but in general, how great of a security risk is it to bring these kinds of detainees into a domestic prison?
The prisoners at Guantanamo Bay are extremely dangerous. They could be housed, easily housed here in the United States with some modifications to, like, Standish Correctional Facility. Everybody has got the same problem and worries about the detainees and their family, people that would like to see them out of prison. You know, the thing is, The person with the bomb strapped to themselves could be here today, could have been here yesterday. We don't know. We can never predict the future.
But all right. Well, it sounds like you're worried about people strapping bombs to themselves. Jonathan Mahler, we welcome him back to the program. He's a writer for The New York Times Magazine, author of The Challenge, How a Maverick Navy Officer and a Young Law Professor Risked Their Careers to Defend the Constitution and Won. That book is out new in paperback. Jonathan Mahler, what is the issue here of suicide bombers at domestic American prisons if the Gitmo detainees were to move stateside?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's I guess if you sort of look at this as an issue in a debate, there is sort of that side of the equation. There's the concern about security, which is a concern you're hearing from some of the local people. Though my understanding is that the people generally in Michigan are kind of welcoming this idea as a possible job creator. But on the other hand, there's also sort of the other issue, which is kind of the more sort of human rights issue and policy issue, which is that, there's a lot of concern out there about whether or not this really would qualify as closing Guantanamo, as President Obama has promised to do, because in effect, all he'd really be doing is moving Guantanamo to the Midwest. So I think you sort of have two separate issues we're dealing with here.
That's exactly right. That some civil libertarians are asking, what difference does it make if these prisoners are, you know, in court in Guantanamo or in Kansas? Does it make a difference?
Yeah, you still have. I mean, essentially, the issue here is you know what what people have objected to, or among the many things, I guess you could say, people have objected to about Guantanamo is the idea that the prisoners could be simply sort of indefinitely detained there without trial and without proper due process. And essentially, at least from what we can gather from the proposals that have been floated about building these this new facility in the United States, or creating this new facility in the United States, that they would allow for a similar kind of indefinite detention. Now, the Obama administration has made it clear that there would be some sort of judicial review. There would be judges reviewing these decisions, et cetera. But the bottom line is we'd still be talking about, kind of an unprecedented act, which is allowing the president to hold prisoners without trial,
right,
without charges for what could be an indefinite period of time.
Well, there's the legal controversy from Jonathan Mahler, but Mayor Baker of Leavenworth, Kansas, I mean, is there precedent at Fort Leavenworth of holding trials inside the prison for certain very, very dangerous inmates?
Not that I'm aware of. One of our concerns was before the trials inside the prisons was part of the plan, was just that, transporting these prisoners to their trials and transporting them in general, because there is no, for example, there is no hospital at Fort Leavenworth. There is only a health care facility. So if there were any emergent health care needs or inpatient health care needs for these detainees, currently there is no facility for them, and they would be put into the general civilian population in a community hospital.
But, Mayor, wouldn't the federal government have some responsibility to supply the security arrangements to make it appropriate in your view, and wouldn't you have some input into that?
I would certainly hope so. At this point in time, from our local government, the city of Leavenworth has received no information about what the federal government would be doing and what we would be responsible for from a city perspective, and what the expectations of our citizens could be. We've received absolutely no information.
So, Mayor Baker, have you contacted federal authorities to express your concerns, to try to, get some information?
Well, we've been relying quite a bit on our congressional delegation, including Senator Roberts, Senator Brownback, and Congresswoman Jenkins. They have always supported our efforts in opposing the relocation, and we have very heavily relied on them to get our point across at a national level.
Yeah, and they certainly are making that point again and again. Paul Pichet, guard at the Standish Correctional Facility in Omer, Michigan. Paul, I mean, you mentioned earlier that there is a legitimate issue of suicide bombers coming to a place that suddenly is a symbol of terrorist detainees. Gitmo is certainly that symbol, but it's hard to reach. It's easier to reach the Standish Correctional Facility. But I suspect you've talked about security arrangements to prevent suicide bombers from getting into your facility before this, right?
Well, yes. I mean, what could happen in speculation today could have happened yesterday. It could happen tomorrow. However, we're close to the expressway. We've got a hospital. We can, with some modifications, we can keep these detainees that we don't want to let out. Standish, the facility itself, is made for Guantanamo Bay prisoners.
Well, we will see what the outcome is. The administration will determine, and hopefully there will be input from local people. Jonathan Mahler, a final word before we go in the last few seconds?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would just say that, I would be less concerned about the security issue. I mean, I think, we have facilities, and we can put facilities into place to house prisoners. The bigger issue for me is that the president actually take real sort of concrete steps,
right,
to close Guantanamo and to deal with the problem of Guantanamo, which is to say, give these people proper trials, adjudicate these cases, find places to resettle these people who are found to not be a danger.
Security challenges, legal challenges. Thanks to Jonathan Mahler, writer for the New York Times Magazine and author of The Challenge. Thanks also to Shea Baker, mayor of Leavenworth, Kansas, and Paul Pichet, a guard at the Standish Correctional Facility in Michigan.
I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Huckenberry. You're listening to The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
This is The Takeaway.
I wonder what Fred Sanford would have thought about Cash for Clunkers, that old schemer. He's fictional, but these folks are real.
Bring in that old jalopy and get up to $4,500 towards the purchase of a new or select used vehicle. That's right, get up to $4,500 for that old piece of junk.
So listeners, that old piece of junk could be your bucket of gold. But wait a minute, junkyard dealers say, whoa, tap on the brakes and proceed with caution. We find out why today on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, August 4th. I'm John Hockenberry. Amy Holmes is with us all week, former Senate speechwriter, political analyst, fan of Sanford and Son.
Clearly. On the show today, it's cars and healthcare on the Hill. And I think it's fair to ask, which one is the clunker?
That's easy.
We'll check in with Secretary Clinton's marathon tour of Africa, and then how an animated movie looks at how Asperger's affects real people every day.
It's a real conversation coming up. But first, I have a question for J.C. Cox, owner of an auto parts salvage business down there in Moultrie, Georgia. J.C., here's my question. Where do clunkers go to die?
After we bring them to our place, they come in with a separate company and crush them for loading. Crush the hive down, then they've sent to a shredder or a pipe company that builds pipes.
It's an environmental story, an economic story. We're going to talk all about the details of Cash for Clunkers in just a moment. Stay with us, J.C. Cox. First, we have everything you need to know in the news. In the headlines today, the White House isn't commenting on former President Bill Clinton's surprise visit to North Korea today. He arrived in an unmarked plane. President Clinton is negotiating for the release of the two American journalists detained there. In the latest economic news, Americans are making less and spending more. Uh-oh. New numbers out this morning show consumer spending was up again in June. That's as some people's income fell more than expected by about 1%. Amy?
U.S. carmakers say that Cash for Clunkers rebate is boosting their sales, but the world's top automaker, Toyota, is reporting an $800 million loss last quarter. Toyota says its outlook for the rest of the year is better. In Washington, the big Senate debate today is on Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. A vote is expected later this week. Shouldn't be a cliffhanger, not a nail-biter, since she has the backing of the Democratic majority.
Clinton, North Korea. There's another Clinton making big diplomatic waves. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is on her way to Africa for an 11-day visit to seven nations. While there, she'll meet with interim leaders of war-torn Somalia. In Afghanistan, the Taliban have fired a series of rockets that hit Kabul today. One of them landed near the American embassy. The attack comes as the Taliban is telling people to boycott the presidential elections coming up. Markets up more than 1% yesterday. The futures trading suggests a flat or possibly negative opening this morning. The S&P starts trading above 1,000, 10.02. The Dow opens this morning at 92.87, and the NASDAQ begins at 20.09. It's happy birthday for President Obama today. You know how old he is?
I think 48 years old.
Not even 50, and he's already president. So what's your birthday wish for the president? Beth from New Jersey has one.
Although I know Obama is not trying to be any kind of fashion icon, I think for his birthday he could use a new pair of nice jeans.
Nice pair of jeans. There's a good birthday.
Presidential jeans.
Yeah, jeans one. Tell us your birthday wish for the president. At 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm just rummaging around here in the junkyard. John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes on The Takeaway. All your Cash for Clunkers coverage here on The Takeaway this morning. J.C. Cox, you still with us?
Yes.
Auto parts salvager in Moultrie, Georgia. He has a business relationship, actually, with Brian Willen, who's a sales manager at Albany Honda in Albany, Georgia. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, John.
You're actually the front end of this Cash for Clunkers sort of trip to the graveyard, right, Brian?
Yes, I guess we are.
All right, we want to talk about the details of that in a moment. But first, Tom Libby, Detroit-based independent auto analyst and president of the Society of Automotive Analysts, joins us from WDET in Detroit. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, John.
Help me out with something. Yesterday, there was some positive news on auto sales, but there was also some really negative news on auto sales. It's clear that the Cash for Clunkers program is having an impact, and you can't escape the commercials anywhere you go. They're all over the market here in New York. Ford seemed to do really well because of Cash for Clunkers, but not so much everybody else.
Well, I think Ford did relatively well for several reasons. One is the Cash for Clunkers, but also Ford's product lineup. They have several newer redesigned products. The Fusion was just redesigned, and it offers a hybrid. You have the all-new Ford Flex. You have an all-new F-150. So Ford has a more fresh lineup, and the freshness of the lineup, the new products, that is a key ingredient in sales.
And so it's really kind of all about timing here. I mean, the government's theory was cash for clunkers. Let's get the clunkers off the road. So you got to have a supply of clunkers. But you also have to have a supply of hybrids and efficient automobiles that satisfy the government's demand. Ford seems to be in the sweet spot here. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. They are in the sweet spot with the products I just mentioned, plus the Focus, which is a fuel-efficient, popular small vehicle. But also, some of the customers that come in on the Cash for Clunkers end up buying something that doesn't qualify for the program. And as I said, because Ford has a wider array of new and fresh products, that will help them, again, even though some of them don't qualify.
Okay, Tom, so I can't resist but ask this question. Doesn't this sort of prove the critics right that if you have a better product, then you're profitable and that GM didn't need all those taxpayer dollars?
Well, I would agree with the first part of the statement in that in this industry, product is really the king, regardless of what programs are in place, what the externalities are. The freshness of the product, the competitiveness of your product portfolio is a key ingredient of your success. Whether or not GM should have gotten the bailout money, to me, that's not that easy to answer.
Well, and we're a little ways downstream from that at this point, which really
right.
downstream
right.
may be a good metaphor here. Brian Willen, sales manager at Albany Honda in Albany. You've been having – Albany, Georgia. You've been having people come in and trade their clunkers in for a new Honda, right?
Yes, we have.
And you've been seeing a pretty brisk uptick in business. Is that what you're saying,
absolutely.
Brian?
Absolutely. Right. Very busy the past few days of the month.
All right. So before we talk about what happens to the clunkers and how well your business is doing, I mean, I got to figure what kind of cars are people bringing in? What sort of dogs are people dragging into Albany Honda there and saying and getting $4,500 for?
Well, we've had some older cars. I think the oldest car we've taken in has been an 85 Cadillac.
85 Caddy, okay.
And that was certainly a clunker.
What other dogs?
We've had a couple of older pickup trucks, you know, with 200,000, 300,000 miles on them.
What brand?
A Ford, and we've had a Dodge and a Chevrolet, so we've got a pretty good mix, actually.
All right, and what are people buying on the other side of the coin?
Our biggest seller, obviously, has been the Honda Accord. That and the Civic as well, which is that's kind of our bread and butter any time of year, with or without a program like this.
Now, how challenging is the paperwork? I mean, you know, it's challenging to do paperwork in any sort of car transaction, and I can remember the headaches that I went through trying to get to the final sticker price. You know, it was a whole big mystery
right.
to me. But to add the federal government cash for clunkers paperwork, I'm wondering if it adds, you know, 3 or 4 hours to the transaction.
Well, for the customer, it doesn't add a whole lot of time. There are some additional forms you have to complete with the customer, but we have to submit for reimbursement online at the website the government set up, and that process is incredibly tedious. It took us 7 hours to submit one transaction, and since then, I mean, we've got over a dozen transactions to process. We haven't been able to get through one because the computer system continues to lock up and kick you out.
Well, it might take a lot of time, but it also makes a lot of sales. Have you seen
yeah.
your sales spike?
Absolutely, absolutely. We probably did 30% of our month in the last 4 days of the month of
wow.
July.
Wow, that is huge. So let's talk about the story of what happens to the poor clunker, that whatever it is, 1985 Caddy. Let's start with that one. What are you supposed to do? I mean, the idea is to get these clunkers off the road for environmental reasons. What do you have to do before they get sent to J.C. Cox down the road to be salvaged, to get them ready?
Right. Well, the instructions we're given is to pour a sodium silicate into the engine. First, remove all the oil, drain the oil, replace the drain plug, and fill the engine or the oil pan with its sodium silicate, and rev the engine up until it seizes and locks up, therefore disabling the engine.
Ooh.
And then, of course, it's ready for the salvager.
Oh, so that basically, J.C. Cox, they're sending you cars with the engines already destroyed, right?
Yes.
So does that make it more difficult for you to economically benefit from this Cash for Clunkers program?
Yes, it hurts the value of the car on my part, because but the way the papers read, I can sell everything but the engine for a period of 6 months.
Now, of course, that's for environmental reasons. We don't want a gas-guzzling caddy engine running around on the road anymore, right?
I suppose so.
You don't sound terribly committed to the program here, J.C.
No, I think in the long run it'll affect my customers that would normally be driving these older cars and buying parts. But in short term, we hope it helps.
Sure, but what about the other side of this, too, that you fix these old clunkers? What happens if there aren't any more?
Yeah, well, our business is mainly the newer cars, but we do have customers that look for the older parts,
right,
too.
Right.
Well, J.C. Cox, think of me as a buzzard here, okay? I'm sitting on a fence, and I'm looking at these cars. What are the most valuable things that you pick right off the car? I guess the airbag is probably the easiest thing to resell, right?
Yeah, possibly, but the older cars are not repaired much, so airbags are not a thing. On these cars, you would get the salvageable, the recycled metals, like the aluminum and the catalytic converter right off, and then the what parts you can sell, you would sell, and after, you know, like we have 6 months to dispose of the car and then notify the government 7 days after we crush it.
So you can't, like, you have to prove to the government that you didn't resell it to Billy over there in the neighborhood next door to you for his first car, for him to hot rod, right?
That's correct. We have 7 days to let them know we received the car. And then we have 7 days after we crush it or shred it to let them know that we've disposed of it.
And how do you prove that you did? Do you sell them the crushed little car?
I'm not exactly sure about that. I'm learning a lot here, too.
Well, but so all you have to do, JC, is just FedEx the big piece of scrap metal to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, okay? And make it, like, overnight, okay?
Okay.
All right, so
we'll try that.
Tom Libby, let's talk some economics there. That's a great sort of explication of the front end to the back end of this Cash for Clunkers program there with Brian and JC Cox. What impact economically, aside from sales, do you think this entire program and maybe follow-on programs are going to have on the industry?
Well, I think short term there will be some positive effects. I mean, when you have greater money flowing into the dealership, that's positive for the employees. They have greater incomes. They will spend that money. That flows through the economy. You also have a lowering of the inventories at the dealerships nationwide, which therefore will raise production by the manufacturers, which will provide more money to the manufacturers and also more money to the suppliers. So all of those positives will trickle through the economy and create positives in that regard in the short term.
Hi, Tom. This is Amy again. Alan Greenspan said this weekend that the popularity of this program is proof of the economy picking back up. Do you share his optimism?
I sort of have mixed feelings because while I think in the short term there's no question this has helped economically as well as psychologically, I mean, it's really pulled the industry out of a negative trend, and that's terrific. On the other hand, frankly, this is completely artificial. I mean, this is money that is being put into the industry from the government. It is not a natural change
right.
in demand. It is an artificial change.
Artificial only in the sense that if you pay people to buy cars, it will have an impact on demand, sort of economics 101. All right, Tom Libby, Detroit-based independent auto analyst and president of the board of the Society of Automotive Analysts, joining us at WDET in Detroit, where we are on the air, as the takeaway. Thanks so much. Brian Willen, sales manager at Albany Honda in Albany, Georgia, along with J.C. Cox, owner of an auto parts salvage business in Moultrie, Georgia. That's the front end to the back end of the Cash for Clunkers supply chain. Only here. I said it would be full coverage.
It was fascinating.
Yeah. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Amy Holmes, and I'm here with John Hockenberry all week. So we have two Clintons on the move this week, as we've been reporting all morning. Hillary arrives in Nairobi, Kenya today. It's the start of an 11-day trip to meet with African leaders. John, some are saying that this is a kiss and make up to the Kenyans after they felt rather snubbed by President Obama skipping them on his Africa trip. Joining us is Will Ross, BBC correspondent in Nairobi, and Stephen Clemens, senior fellow of the New America Foundation and blogger for The Washington Note. Thanks for joining us, gentlemen.
Good morning.
So, Will, we start with you. We spoke to you in West Africa on the day President Obama arrived in Ghana. Now we turn to you in East Africa on the day that Hillary arrives. How will Kenya welcome Hillary? What do you say?
Well, she'll get a pretty good welcome, I think, although, to be honest, one of the big problems here in Nairobi is the traffic on a normal day, and security is tight, and there are monumental traffic jams across town. So for many Kenyans, it is a royal pain, this entire visit, but many companies that are trying to export goods to the United States, they'll be hoping that she brings a good message. And also, there's a big feeling here that a hope, rather, that Hillary Clinton is going to get a bit stuck into the Kenyan politicians who are causing a few enemies amongst the Kenyan population at the moment. Some of them were accused of being behind the terrible post-election violence last year, and some of them are now being accused of running away from justice, and just maybe Hillary Clinton will have a few harsh words to shake up some of these Kenyan politicians.
So despite the traffic jams and snarls that she might be causing, is her trip there, or starting there anyway, smoothing some of those ruffled feathers?
Well, we'll have to wait and see what she says, because certainly Kenya is in a pretty precarious political situation at the moment. You might remember that early last year, more than 1,000 people were killed in some of the worst fighting that Kenya has seen in a long time. This is post-election violence, which politicians and business people were helping to instigate. Now, there's been efforts by civil society to ensure that some of these politicians are brought to book. And the idea of setting up a local tribunal in Kenya was thrown out by the cabinet last week. That was widely seen as an attempt by senior politicians to run away from justice. So maybe Hillary Clinton, as the America's top diplomat, will be able to have some harsh words and some strong criticism and tell the Kenyan politicians to do the right thing. Because bear in mind that Barack Obama, whose father was from Kenya, is not really seen as particularly neutral here in Kenya, because his father obviously belonged to one tribe. So maybe it's something that Hillary Clinton can do a bit more easily than actually the president himself would be able to do.
Well, I want to bring in Stephen Clemens to kind of look at the bigger picture of Hillary's Africa tour. What is her agenda? What's the goal here?
Her agenda here is to check off the continent for President Obama. You know, I think Africans, for understandable reasons, often look at themselves as sort of the lowest on the totem pole and sort of in the backwaters of the international system, and don't get a lot of attention compared to, you know, other significant continents. There are almost four dozen countries in Africa, and Barack Obama is trying to send the signal that Africa matters, that he's concerned about its development. What we're not seeing yet from either Hillary, even though she's opening up the Sub-Saharan African Trade and Economic Cooperation Forum, which is an economic summit, and I think it's terrific that she's going there for that reason, as opposed to yet another aid summit or problems dealing with, you know, the downside of Africa. This is more of a constructive, forward-looking agenda program, and I think that's the message that Obama and Clinton are trying to send, is that Africa matters, that America's engaged, and it's just the beginning of a relationship. But she's going to seven countries through the continent, and this is really just checking off that box.
So you think that this is more symbolic than substantive?
Well, Well, I think right now it has to be more symbolic than substantive. We need to demonstrate with senior American leadership and participation a presence there. And I've been very impressed that Hillary Clinton has been putting in the time, not only here, but in places in Southeast Asia, because there was this joke going in China for a while that its grand strategy was to keep America distracted in small Middle Eastern nations while it could go on a charm offensive for the rest of the world. China, for instance, is very deeply engaged in building infrastructure throughout Africa. And the United States just showing up to something with someone of the stature of Hillary Clinton can have positive effects. But there are substantive things there. We worry about the building of sanctuaries in Somalia for Islamic terrorists. We worry about oil politics with Angola and Nigeria. We are worried about economic development. And then there's some concern about the ongoing, you know, development challenges in the region. We don't have an AID director, an Agency of International Development director, even nominated yet. And so to some degree, Hillary Clinton is acting as the super aid or, you know, AID director for the region.
Okay, so,
and sending signals that we're still engaged.
Sure. So let's move this conversation from Africa to Foggy Bottom and talk about some of the politics that are going on here in Washington. Obama got his six-month scorecard. How would you rate Hillary? How has she done these first 6 months?
I think on the whole, she's done very well. As I said, she is moving around the world, putting in a strong presence and showing American involvement. And that's a very important part on the front end of diplomacy. I think that Hillary Clinton has gone out and given herself a makeover when, you know, at the beginning there were some priorities she had that were different than President Obama. She's shown that there's very little distance, if any, between the two of them. And I think from her experience as First Lady before, but also with some of her husband's activities, who's, you know, as you mentioned, off in North Korea. But when he was working with the Clinton Global Initiative, a lot of those programs focused on African development, poverty assistance, and somewhat, you know, state building, if you will, and civil society building. And I think on that broad agenda, she's moving all of these courses while at the same time being quite supportive of President Obama in trying to figure out if we can get our relations with Russia, with China, and even with countries like Iran on a different track. So she's got an incredibly full plate, and none of the you know, things she's juggling has yet fallen and crashed on the floor, which is fairly impressive when you compare it to even the beginning of Bill Clinton's administration, and particularly under George W. Bush's. So I give her a B, and I think she's doing quite well.
Thanks, Steve, for that. That was Steve Clemens, Senior Fellow and Director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation, blogger also for The Washington Note. We were also joined by Will Ross, BBC correspondent in Nairobi. Thank you, gentlemen.
Now, he raved that entire interview and then gave her a B.
Yeah, I thought he was going to come up with an A, actually.
I was surprised by that. Here are some other stories we're following. North Korea welcomed former President Bill Clinton to Pyongyang with flowers and handshakes today. Does he get an A? He's there to negotiate for the release of two American journalists detained in North Korea. That's the grade there. In Thailand, a plane skidded off a runway and crashed into an air traffic control tower today. After landing on a resort island, one pilot is dead. Dozens aboard are injured. Back in Washington, the Senate will go a few rounds debating the Supreme Court nomination of Sonia Sotomayor today, and then the vote will confirm her. It's expected later this week. And it's a tough time at the post office. The agency is facing a $7 billion loss this year. It might have to close 700 offices. Coming up, the healthcare debate, home in the hustings.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Ring the bell!
Not only make sure that all Americans have access to the best medicine...
They already do!
Yikes, John, are these town halls or town roasts?
Sound of democracy in action in America.
Indeed. As Congress goes home, it's all about the messaging, the battle of the bullets, only metaphorically speaking there. Democrats are honing their attacks on the insurance industry while Republicans are emphasizing costs.
But that's people at a town hall meeting that you can actually find on YouTube screaming at Kathleen Sebelius, Health
screaming.
And Human Services Secretary, and Senator Arlen Specter, newly a Democrat from Pennsylvania.
Well, we decided to send our own reporters out to some town halls to get their firsthand reporting on the issues. Adam Allington is a reporter for KWMU in St. Louis, Missouri, and Michael Puente is a reporter for Chicago Public Radio. He joins us from Northwest Indiana. Both have been covering the local reaction for The Takeaway. And of course, we're joined by our friend Todd Zwillick, The Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Thanks for joining me, gentlemen.
Good morning.
So first, let's get out of the Beltway bubble and follow these politicians home. Michael, you attended a town hall meeting last night. Where'd you go?
I went to this little setting in Chesterton, Indiana, which is about 40 minutes east of Chicago, where Congressman Peter Viskovsky, who's a congressman of the area, was invited to speak on a variety of issues, but mainly health care. And there, got a little rough for him. I mean, there was about 100, maybe 150 people in the hall itself, but outside there were protesters. I mean, it was kind
wow.
of a crazy.
Well, let's take a listen at what you heard. So, Michael, did you get the impression that these were organized protesters, or was this just a spontaneous eruption of apparently sheer anger?
No, this wasn't spontaneous. This was definitely organized by those who are, you know, dead bent against having any kind of national health care program. And they want their voices heard, and they got it. I'm not sure how effective it's going to be since the debate rages on. But they were out there fully organized with signs and really, really a lot of energy and emotion.
Let's bring Adam Allington, public radio reporter for KWMU in St. Louis, into this. You're picking up buzz from your listeners. Are passions running equally as high?
Oh, definitely. Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill held a town hall meeting in St. Louis last week, and it was much the same reaction. About 300 people, very emotional, and the people who sort of turned out to raise their voice of protest against health care reform spoke, you know, much louder than those who just sort of turned out to, you know, ask questions and you know, maybe give their perspective. It was a pretty heated meeting.
I understand that you spoke to one of your listeners actually outside of your studio, Michael Buckley. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I spoke to Michael Buckley in downtown St. Louis. St. Louis is a big city, so with that, there are quite a few Democrats in St. Louis. But I would say Michael is fairly typical of outstate Missourians who are very skeptical of health care reform. They don't see health care reform as being as urgent as, say, the economy was when then-Senator Obama was campaigning in Missouri. They look around and they see, you know, around 80% of Missourians who have health insurance, and they just don't see the need to push reform
through. Yeah, let's listen to what, Adam, let's listen to what Michael told you about his views.
I tell him not to pass it.
And why is that?
I'm not in favor of it. I think it's socialist. And I don't like the idea at all. It's going to cost too much. It's going to have people lose their insurance coverage. I don't like the abortion funding provisions that are in there. It's just not a good bill. And nobody's read the thing.
Adam, during the election, though, Obama drew really huge crowds in Missouri, I think like 100,000 folks. Does it seem that the political tides are shifting on this health care debate?
I don't know if they're shifting as much as Missourians just look around and they don't see the urgency in the same way as they saw the economy. The President Obama hasn't been able to tap into the fears most Missourians had about the economy, and it's been a hard sell for him. And he's had congressmen and senators out, trying to drum up support for this, and it just hasn't been. You know, it hasn't been happening to the same degree that he's had for economic reform.
Well, and it's going to be a real challenge during this recess, and we're going to get a take from Todd Zwillick in just a moment. But Michael Puente, you know, here's someone that you spoke with, Jule Kozlowski, who was at that town meeting, and you can actually hear in this clip of tape just how challenging it is for someone who wants information about health care to make it through the sort of drumbeat that's going on in the background. Listen.
I really believe we need health care reform desperately. I am very happy with my own insurance, but there are many, many other people who need it desperately, who don't have jobs, who are being screwed into the ground by being sick. It's just a terrible situation.
Frustration, eh, Michael Puente?
It is frustration, John, and also because, you know, they were actually a little bit earlier on there, chanting at me because they wanted me to go to their site to talk to them.
Wow.
They're chanting like coward to me. So I'm like, I'll get over there. And once I got over there, it was actually pretty difficult to even talk to them because there's a lot of them were just, they don't trust the media itself. So it was really a buzz over there.
So Todd Zwillick, I want to bring you into this conversation. You've been listening to all of this. Let's turn to the politics. Axelrod called the insurance companies mercurial. Pelosi called them villainous. That's the message that they're going into the recess. Do you think that that is a winning strategy?
Well, you can really see, Amy, why the Democrats wanted to get this done so quickly. Remember all those deadlines? The president wanted to get it done by the August recess. Makes sense now, doesn't it? I think they knew this was coming. How easy it is to organize people, whether it's Republican operatives or the insurance industry or just people who just plain don't like these bills, coming out to these town halls, which the Blue Dogs and other Democrats said were for educational purposes. Let members meet their constituents. Well, now it's turning into, in some cases, a protest venue or a bit of a circus.
Waterloo comes to mind.
Well, Waterloo comes to mind, and it's way too early to tell what will eventually happen. I think a lot of people, even if they are drummed up and against some of the details of this bill, or even maybe against some of the notions of what they think is in the bill, whether it is or isn't. You know, we've had Republican members on the House floor saying that this bill is going to put senior citizens to death and that the government will be forcing them into euthanasia. Just not true. So there's some emotional aspects of this as well.
Todd Zwillick, quick yes or no. Do you think Democrats are going to be able to sort of get it together and get their own counter-protesting, their own people at these town halls?
I don't know if that's their strategy or not, but I'm going to tell you they're going to have to counter this with a very strong message of why the country needs reform, and they want the president to make the case loud and clear. They need the commander-in-chief on this.
Todd, thank you so much for joining us. We were also joined by Adam Allington, public radio reporter for KWMU in St. Louis, Michael Puente, reporter and Northwest Indiana bureau chief for Chicago Public Radio, Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
Coming up, Asperger's syndrome on the big screen. Does Hollywood like Asperger's? We'll find out.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And back to school this year is complicated by the H1N1 swine flu problem. Parents are worried about the start of the new school year. Are schools going to be closed? What are the precautions being taken by school districts across the country? Well, the federal government is finalizing some guidelines that might help or complicate matters further. Joining us to talk about the guidelines and what we know about them is Spencer Hsu, Homeland Security reporter for The Washington Post. Good morning, Spencer.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
So what is the Obama administration trying to do here? Reveal some guidelines that are going to be practical but not cause panic, and how do you keep that balance?
Right. They're trying to beat this deadline. Experts believe that flu cases will surge once schools come back in and the fall flu season begins. They're also trying to be clearer than they did in the spring and avoid what one official called knee-jerk decisions. You know, the key issue here is that in the spring, when the flu first emerged, and the president himself echoed CDC guidance that if you have a child with symptoms or with a confirmed case, that the school should close for up to 2 weeks. Within 5 days, 500,000 students were out of school, and there was a big pushback that this was affecting SATs and graduations and everything else.
It also was contributing to actually transmission of the disease in the sense that these kids went home and there were sort of other vectors for transmitting the disease, right?
Exactly, and that it may not have been effective because the disease was already spreading, was already present here, was already prevalent through the communities. And it's useful to note that the New York City Health Commissioner at the time did not follow this guidance, and that New York City Commissioner Tom Friedman is now director of CDC. So the government now is undertaking what it hopes will be a more refined approach. Sort of the simple way to understand is they're going to recommend that schools generally stay open unless that school has children with underlying medical conditions or special needs, that the best approach is to have sick children stay home. It'll put a bigger burden on parents, but they think it'll save the burden on society and let healthy children learn.
So focus the guidelines on keeping kids who have symptoms at home, but keep the school open as much as possible, and it would be a center of both disseminating information and possibly even preventive practices inside the school. Now, the good news on the, you know, what happened earlier this year is that when the federal government issued these guidelines, the school districts actually followed them. Now, short of real actual coordination with Homeland Security, what expectation do we have that these guidelines are going to be faithfully carried out by school districts this fall?
You put your finger on one of the main concerns here, and it's one for not just DHS, but Health and Human Services and the White House as well, is that there's a chicken and egg issue. If the government comes forward with recommendations that are too disruptive of society, but the public doesn't see this as being a severe illness, they're worried that the public won't listen. On the other hand, if they wait until the public sees perhaps an outbreak getting worse, the time to have taken action may have passed by. So the government here is trying to kind of do a balancing act, follow the science, ground all its decisions in science, make the first priority public health, but also to keep the public with them. And in doing that, they're trying to explain as they go. They're saying, look, this disease is not as severe as first feared. It may be similar in lethality to the seasonal flu, but it will infect maybe two or three times as many people. And unlike a normal flu, it will infect children and young people most.
Okay, in the few seconds before we go, Spencer, when are we going to have a final decision on these guidelines?
We're told within days. They need to do it by the beginning of August, and of course we're in the first half of August now.
Advice to parents getting ready for your back-to-school ritual. The guidelines will be in a few days. Guidelines for school closings when H1N1 rears its ugly head this fall. Spencer Hsu is a Homeland Security reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you, Spencer.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes. Coming up in just a minute, the star of the movie Adam, it's not an actor, could be a syndrome, Asperger's syndrome. Look at Asperger's in the movies right after some of the news stories we're following this morning. Amy?
We're just getting news in that former President Bill Clinton reportedly met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-il on his surprise visit to Pyongyang. That's according to North Korea's official news agency. The report says President Clinton also conveyed a verbal message from President Obama. He arrived in North Korea today to negotiate the release of two American journalists held there. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton arrives in Africa today. She's making an 11-day, seven-nation tour of the continent. She'll kick off her visit in Kenya, where she'll address a trade forum. Back in the United States, the full Senate begins debate today on Sonia Sotomayor's nomination to the Supreme Court. A Democratic majority means she's expected to be approved later this week.
American consumers upped their spending for the second straight month. The Commerce Department reported an increase of 0.4% last month, while personal income fell 1.3%. It's an indication of the dark economic times when Toyota loses $819 million, and that's better than what was projected. Aggressive cost-cutting is credited with the so-called improvement. Australian police say they thwarted the terrorist plot of an Al-Qaeda-linked group that was planning to invade an Australian military base. More than 400 Australian state officers took part in multiple raids in Melbourne this morning.
Police in Sudan fired tear gas and beat protesters outside of Khartoum Criminal Court today. The women were there to protest the trial of a female journalist accused of indecency for wearing pants. That's a look at some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
So Hollywood, we know, has a lot of favorite narratives. There's the guy gets the girl. There's the girl gets the guy. Romantic narratives. Those are famous. But there are also disease narratives. You know what I'm talking about? Remember the movie Love Story?
Love Story, right? Beaches.
Everything was going fine, and terminal cancer, boom, she dies, or he dies. It appears that Hollywood's latest sort of disease narrative or syndrome narrative or medical narrative might be Asperger's syndrome. Here's a clip from the movie Adam.
I have this thing that's called Asperger's syndrome.
Oh.
Albert Einstein, Thomas Jefferson, Mozart.
They had Asperger's?
Probably.
The movie Adam is out, and joining us to talk about it is David Corcoran, who's a health editor for the New York Times Science Times. He's right here in the studio. David, good morning.
Good morning.
And David Edelstein, a film critic for the New York Magazine, joins us. Welcome back to the program. Good morning, David.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you, Sean.
All right. Before we review the film, let's talk a little bit, David Corcoran, about the sort of scientific elements here. The idea that Hollywood falls in love with something like Asperger's syndrome, it could be a double-edged sword. In the sense that Asperger's would strike me as kind of a fabulous favorite kind of syndrome for Hollywood, in the sense that on the one hand it seems like a tragic sort of form of possibly mental retardation, incorrectly stated, but it also bestows the victim with special powers, like in the movie Rain Man.
Yeah, Asperger's syndrome is a special diagnosis. It's on the autism spectrum,
right?
Most experts think. Meaning that people with Asperger's have autistic traits. Typically, they are not mentally retarded, and certainly they are not like the Dustin Hoffman character in Rain Man, who was profoundly autistic, but a savant who could do these amazing calculations in his head. People with Asperger's have a very distinctive set of behaviors, and it's very easily diagnosed if you know what to look for.
And a movie like this in your family has what kind of an impact?
Well, my 23-year-old son, Daniel, has Asperger's syndrome. And so it was with special interest that I went to see the screening of Adam.
My first book is about the experience of growing up with a disability in the United States. And when I was out on a book tour years and years ago, I remember an individual who came to one of my readings, was profoundly autistic, described very movingly how important the movie Rain Man was to him to be able to say to people when they asked, what does it mean to have autism? He could just go, it's like that movie Rain Man. And he also saw himself on the screen. But for his parents, the movie was much more of a complication in the sense that your son is like Dustin Hoffman, so you're winning lots of money at poker. It was a double-edged sword for the family. How is it experienced for you?
Well, in the first place, when Daniel was growing up, Asperger's syndrome didn't really exist as a diagnosis in this country. Nobody knew what it was. So we took him to a series of doctors, psychiatrists, neurologists, and nobody was able to really put his finger on the diagnosis. It wasn't until Dan was 8 or 9 that we learned what it was he had.
And does this movie help to explain, and journalistically speaking, does it give information to people in a valid way?
Yeah, I think it does. The portrayal of a young man with Asperger's by the British actor Hugh Dancy is very lifelike. It's very, very well done.
Well, let's listen to another clip from the movie Adam, and here's Hugh Dancy playing that character.
The Cherry Lane Theater is the oldest continuously running theater off Broadway. It was converted from a box factory in 1924, and then in the 20s and 30s and 40s, it presented the work of writers such as F. Scott Fitzgerald, John Dos Passos, Eugene O'Neill.
I used to bone up on conversation topics, too, when I had a date.
So it was a father and son describing the complexity of going out on a date, and it is a love story, Adam is. But here, Hugh Dancy, as Adam, is conveying this, like, tons of information that's in his head. Part of Asperger's.
Yeah, it's not that he boned up. It's that he knew that stuff. And he'll just talk. He'll talk continuously until somebody stops him.
David, you saw the movie Adam, right?
Yeah.
What did you think?
Well, I think it transcends that disease of the week, Oscar bait kind of movie. I don't like the schlocky music, but it is a great primer on Asperger's. I mean, it's not really close to Rain Man. That's very far out on the spectrum, as David said. This is really about a guy in a relationship who has to try to teach himself how to communicate, how to develop empathy, which many Aspergians, since they don't know how to read signals in other people, how can you develop an empathetic relationship with another person? And I think the movie is very realistic in presenting that as a real impediment, perhaps a fatal impediment in terms of achieving true love.
Let me just remind people, David Edelstein, film critic for New York Magazine, is there, and David Corcoran, health editor for the New York Times, Science Times, is here in the studio.
I want to say about your other point. I mean, my wife, Rachel Clayman, edited the wonderful book Look Me in the Eye by John Elder Robison, brother of Augustine Burroughs. And what struck me was how grateful he was late in life to have his syndrome recognized. He'd managed to thrive as a techie. He actually designed those smoke-belching guitars for the group Kiss. But, you know, he'd walk through the halls where these nubile young women were throwing themselves at everyone, and he didn't particularly care about that. He was just interested in his guitars. And
great
it was like,
point.
What's wrong with him, you know?
Great point.
David, this is Amy Holmes talking.
Hi.
You say that it transcends the, you know, movie of the week sort of schlockiness, but doesn't it also present a storyline that is familiar to Hollywood, which is man learns to love, man learns to communicate, man learns about himself?
Well, I don't want to give anything away, but he really doesn't. Eventually we see that he has huge, huge blocks, and that he is apt to fly off the handle at any moment when he thinks that people are lying to him, because he can't lie. He blurts everything out.
I see.
Well, and we should say, and of course that was a storyline in Liar Liar, right, which was a movie like almost 10 years ago.
That's the trait has often been used in the past for laughs. I mean, you put an Asperger on screen and you can just giggle like crazy, especially if he's some kind of wonk.
But that's not what's going on here.
No, it's the first time we've really seen it from the character's point of view.
Well, David Edelstein, film critic for New York Magazine. David Corcoran, let me just ask you. I mean, it sounds, and Amy sort of alluded to it a moment ago, that Asperger's on some level is a metaphor for the complexity of relationships and human communication. I'm wondering if you have a screenplay in your own household, David.
Well, sure. I think everybody who has lived with this disorder has a million stories to tell. I think what's good about this movie is that it does not sugarcoat the condition at all. You really get to see the guy in full. As David says, the movie Rain Man, the Dustin Hoffman character is very well played, but he's really just a plot element.
It's outlandish.
Right.
Yeah. It's
yeah,
convenient for the
story about Tom Cruise's character.
Exactly. And I think this movie...
Opportunistic, that's what you would say, David.
Yeah, I think this movie, Adam, really transcends that.
Talking about the movie Adam with David Corcoran, health editor for the New York Times, and David Edelstein, film critic for New York Magazine. Asperger's is the star of Adam.
We've been asking all morning for your birthday wishes to the president. Here's one listener's wish.
The gift that I would give President Obama for his birthday is an armored vest for all the backstabbing, lying, conniving politicians he has to deal with.
Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. She has strong feelings.
Go to our website where you can order armored vests for the president. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Amy Holmes, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.